Case numbers 2038 and 2015-88, Allison Taylor versus the City of Saginaw et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Ellison, you may proceed for the plaintiff.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Philip Ellison appearing on behalf of the appellant this morning. Your Honors, I'm sure there's a few of us sitting in the courtroom today that have walked out of a courthouse and walked up to the back end of our cars and saw the dreaded chalk mark that none of us want to see, only to be even angrier when we find out we get a parking ticket based on that chalk mark. And of course, what we're arguing here today is that not only does it offend us when we get that parking ticket, it also offends the Fourth Amendment. Your Honors, the case comes before you, this is the second time, and this court has the benefit and also the limitation of Taylor 1. Taylor 1 provides, I think, a very strong structural support to establish that.
Can I ask you a preliminary question? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm just curious about the process. Can you challenge the parking ticket in the state of Michigan, or county court or whatever it is? I mean, can you raise the Fourth Amendment argument in that process?
In Michigan, the answer is no. So in an administrative proceedings in Michigan, the administrative process does not provide the ability to challenge on Fourth Amendment grounds. You can challenge on factual grounds. For example, my car wasn't parked there, right? And you're issued an erroneous ticket. If you want to challenge a constitutional challenge in Michigan, it has to be before a court.
But you could get there.
Well, that's what this case is. I could have brought it in state court, but there is no appeal from or a challenge that you could raise on a Fourth Amendment grounds without bringing a separate, independent, standalone challenge in state court. It would be a normal Fourth Amendment case. It'd be just like this one.
You have to bring a 1983 claim.
1983 claim,
the
exactly.
The only way you can do it. No, I would know that, but.
Well, no way that I can find.
But yeah, I haven't gotten many parking tickets.
Well, that's one of the benefits of being a federal judge is that you tend not to get tickets, I think, all that much. I think, but...
Because I have a reserve parking
spot. Well, there you go. I'm sure there's a number of us, and I'm sure your clerks here will tell you, and I'm sure they have a fair amount of parking tickets parking outside of courtrooms when they don't have reserve parking. But the interesting part here today is that Judge Ludington, as part of the lower court case on remand, decided this case on the administrative search exception.
You were starting to talk about Taylor 1. Taylor 1 held that this is a search.
Correct.
And that's the law of the case. It's also it's a published opinion. It's binding precedent. And Taylor 1 also rejected the vehicle exception and the caretaking function exception.
Correct.
But left open the administrative exception that we're talking today. Is that correct?
That is correct, and largely just because it wasn't raised on appeal the first. Because, of course, the first time, much like we were just talking, you were just talking to the last counsel, this was at the 12B6 stage the last time it was here. This time it's at the Rule 56 stage.
Can a 12B6 decision establish law of the case?
I believe so, yes. I mean,
how? It's just on the adequacy of the pleading.
Well, I would suggest that when the case comes before the court in a 12B6, you have to assume all the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint is true, obviously, well-established principle. What I think the city could have done was establish that some of the facts that were pled in our complaint were not true or were contrary to what we pled. And what we have here is not that. What we have here is that we established that the exact way that we argued that the ticketing process worked and what happened. And there's largely, I don't think, a much dispute as to what actually happened.
What does the record generally consist of? I know there was a deposition of the defendant, and there were some documents, I assume. Is there anything else? Like, what is in the record?
I think the most central document for us is it's a docket entry 68-5, which is the affidavit of Ms. Taylor.
Okay.
Basically, it establishes all the facts that we've alleged in our, and this is factually not a complicated case, obviously. We provided a little more detail as to why Ms. Taylor was parking.
There's no real difference, and I didn't glean any, but I'm curious if I was missing something. Any real difference between what the complaint said and as a matter of fact, and your friend on the other side may disagree, but as a matter of fact, and then what the record actually showed.
The only, if I'll paraphrase you, is any surprise that came out with discovery was the parking official attempted to argue that in some tickets she writes down the actual license plate as opposed to marking the tire itself. But for us, it doesn't really, that, to me, that's a red herring, because we are challenging only the using of the chalk itself, not when she, if she used a process that was otherwise, we would only be looking at those who have a marked tire, and we have that in the record.
Go ahead.
If I may, just finish up. We have over 100,000 photographs that were produced as part of discovery that show every tire that was marked, because their device that the city of Saginaw purchased allowed the ticket issuer to take, and they usually took three photographs of the tire, the license plate, and the vehicle itself. So we know who got marked and got a ticket as a result of that. To the extent that there was this argument that, we call it the surprise, is that some of these things may have been issued pursuant to a handwritten, but from our standpoint, as our case, we don't care about those.
But wait, don't you have to care about those? Because this is a 1983 claim, so
Correct.
You have to show both causation and damages.
Correct.
Your damages that you've claimed are the parking tickets that were issued.
Correct.
So if, in fact, the city could show that for each one of these they had an alternative method of proof, wouldn't that just be sort of an analog to an inevitable discovery claim? In other words, well, you would have gotten the parking tickets anyway.
No, and the reason why the answer is no is that I want you to step back and think about the parking, it's Tabitha Hoskins is her name. When Ms. Hoskins walks up to a vehicle, she has two methods she can use.
Yeah.
She can chalk the tire or she can write it down. We have all the records of every tire she chalked.
Right, but what if she also wrote it down?
We're not asking for relief for those individuals. We're only asking for relief for those that got chalked.
No. I thought that the city's position, and I'll ask the city, was that in each case we did both.
No. And my understanding of the record, and that was Ms. Hoskins' testimony, was...
And that would cash out at some... I mean, if we were to send this back, it'd cash out later when you're trying to prove your damages, I assume.
Correct. And to be clear, we've got two...
Although maybe not, because maybe you didn't plead causation, so maybe we should talk about it.
Well, the only thing I would point out would be is that we've got two classes, essentially. We have our general full class for every individual that's ever been chalked, and then we have a sub-damages class for those that were chalked that resulted in a loss to a parking ticket. So the larger class is everyone that got chalked.
Wait a minute. So what are their damages?
It's a 23B2 class. It's an injunctive or declaratory class, and then a damages subclass.
I see, but hasn't the city said they aren't chalking anymore? So is that...
They only did that after this court issued Tailored 1.
Yeah, but what difference does that make? Didn't in the Supreme Court case involving the Second Amendment, didn't the city of New York repeal its ordinance, and the Supreme Court said...
There was nothing repealed here. The practice of the parking official simply stopped at the directive, as I understand, the directive of her boss. There was nothing voted on. There was no policy change. There was no ordinance change, for example. It's just this court said in Taylor 1, and of course, as the court may well know, it got a tremendous amount of press, which we didn't anticipate in any way, shape, or form. And as a result of that, they just simply voluntarily stopped. I would argue to you it's a voluntary cessation question.
I see. And so maybe that, whatever the name of the Supreme Court case is distinguishable, perhaps, maybe.
Well, so I would be, just from my own knowledge, it's Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth, the Supreme Court has held that if a defendant voluntarily stops the process, even though the court case has already, after the court case has already been started, it does not moot the actual issue. And in fact, the city of Saginaw has done nothing to actually, adopt new policies, adopt new changes, they've not changed their ordinance or their law in any way. What's interesting, though, is that they don't actually have an ordinance that actually provides for to do this chalk. It's a practice of the community itself. Now, I'm sorry.
A minor issue in this case is qualified immunity for Hopkins.
Correct.
And I know you're appealing that, too, but can't you kind of admit or concede that the law is unsettled, that all reasonable parking enforcers would not know that this violated the Fourth Amendment, and therefore Hoskins is really entitled to qualified immunity? I mean, that's a minor part of the case, and I know you're appealing it, but
you
almost got to concede that's a weak part, isn't it?
I'm not going to concede it just because I'm a plaintiff's attorney, and we can't possibly concede qualified immunity. But I will say, the next question out of your mouth is going to be, Mr. Ellison, give me the name of the case that establishes that principle. It's Jones. If Jones, and so the only reason why I would point to this court, and I would actually pair it on Eppley's counsel that was here before, the other Taylor case, as I like to call it, Taylor versus Rios, as well as the McCoy case, the Supreme Court has gone back to the Hope standard, and Hope says if it's apparent, and I would point this court to page 25 of my third brief, the third brief filed in this double appeal, and I lay out the three bullet points as to why a reasonable officer, it would be apparent to them in light of Jones.
A reasonable parking official. Come on. I mean, you're talking about somebody that doesn't have a whole lot of training here. And, I mean, lawyers, we are debating about whether this is a Fourth Amendment violation. We're supposed to know the parking enforcer is supposed to know what the law is.
Well, then what we're requiring is we're requiring a case directly on all fours. And that's not the standard, obviously.
Well, but Taylor wasn't a Fourth Amendment. The other Taylor, the Supreme Court.
Correct.
Taylor versus Rios was not a Fourth
Amendment. It was an Eighth Amendment case, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and in the Fourth Amendment, like Westby, the Supreme Court has told us over and over and over again, in a Fourth Amendment case, you have to have a very narrow focus, a very specific level of generality.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, because it's a minor point of the case, but...
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Just related, I guess, but Jones itself held out the idea that the search could be reasonable, right? I mean, in other words, Jones said it's a search, but the reasonableness was not raised, right?
I would agree.
So why, and we're talking about de minimis, administrative,
right,
community caretaking, things that would go to reasonableness.
Correct.
So why wouldn't that say it's not clearly established if there's a whole part of Jones that doesn't even... they don't even get to this part that we're talking about now.
My response to that would be is that because at that point, once you've established there's a search and Jones establishes that there's a search, it's presumed per se unconstitutional unless and until the government, who has the burden in that circumstance, establishes that they fit with an exception. It's not my burden, at least I would take the position, it's not my burden that once a search has been established, and I think Jones establishes that when you trespass onto a vehicle for the purposes of extracting information about that vehicle, that's a search. The burden shifts to them then. And as a result here, that burden has not been, and I don't think they've established that here today.
Maybe our first decision took care of this, but what do we do with the idea that the restatement and other sources, when we're talking about trespass to chattels,
right,
requires damage or harm, and I don't see a lot of damage or harm to the car.
Well, there's not one thing I would, if I may, the response I would have to that is that any trespass itself, it does not require an actual physical harm in order for a destruction of a piece of property for it to be a trespass to chattels. What I would argue is that in the common law is that simply trespassing itself was enough to be sufficient. What separates a Fourth Amendment violation, which Jones lays out really well, is it's not just the trespass. It's the trespass plus the second element, which is to extract information to take some sort of government purpose. And we have that here.
I know our time is up.
Go ahead.
We haven't talked at all about sort of the status of the exceptions.
Correct.
So I would like to get your position on, you know, most of these exceptions to the Fourth Amendment are CATS exceptions, right? That we have the reasonable expectation of privacy sort of lens, then we have a lot of exceptions that sort of go to that. Jones comes in and says, we're now in a trespass, we have this alternative way.
Correct.
Is it your position that none of the exceptions survive if it's under a trespass model? If some of them survive, which ones, and how do I know which ones? Because all of my models are under CATS.
How I analyzed this and argued to the Taylor 1 court is that the CATS and Jones model define the scope of what is a search. And then once we've established it's a search, the Fourth Amendment presumes, if there's no warrant, that it is unconstitutional. The burden then shifts to the government to say there is an alternate to the warrant process, and if it can fulfill one of those exceptions.
But you think those exceptions all map on to trespass, they still survive. So if they could fall within...
Is that your position?
That's my position. I don't see how they don't, because...
The Pacific Legal Foundation took the opposite.
So you agree, if they could show administrative exception, if they could show de minimis, if they could show probable cause, if they could show any of the consent, if they could show any of those, then they would win.
That's how we've been prosecuting this case, exactly. That's been our position. And just to, and if I may...
They don't apply. The administrative search doesn't apply.
They don't work here, but they would be available to some plaintiff.
Someplace down. And if I may, just one last point, is that Judge Ludington only decided this on the administrative search. Judge Griffin, Judge Larson, you were both on the panel where I was before you in a case called Benjamin versus Stemple, which established what's required in an administrative search. This doesn't fit there at all. I mean, that decision establishes that you have to have a pre-search administrative neutral detention, and we don't have that here.
Pre-compliance,
and there's just no pre-compliance here whatsoever. Unless the court panel has any other questions.
Have your 3 minutes.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Kaylin Piper on behalf of the City of Saginaw and Tabitha Hoskins. This honorable court previously stated, we chalk this up to a regulatory exercise. The district court correctly held that the administrative search exception applies because automobiles are pervasively regulated, the city's police powers and local ordinance authorize and define the scope of the inspections, and the type of warrantless inspections involved in this case are necessary to further the statutory scheme.
I'm sorry to jump right in, but is there any other case in which, when you say pervasive regulation, that normally applies to industries, right? So is there another case that would help us think about how pervasively regulated would apply to individuals? In other words, I mean, Ms. Taylor parked her car. So she's not Ford Motor Company, which might be a pervasively regulated industry. So how does that map?
Sure. There's New York versus Class, which was cited in the district court's opinion. The Supreme Court held that automobiles are justifiably the subject of pervasive regulation, and that's a quote, and that's 475 U.S. 106, 1986. There's also South Dakota v. Opperman. Automobiles, unlike homes, are subject to pervasive and continuing government regulation. That's 428 U.S. 364, 1976. And finally, Caddy versus Dombrowski, and the Supreme Court recognized the extensive regulation of automobiles in traffic. And that's 413 U.S. 433, 1973. So moving on from pervasive...
And can I just ask you one more question?
Sure.
In all of those cases, were they found to fit within the administrative search exception because of the pervasive regulation of automobiles, and it was because of something that a person did as opposed to something Ford Motor Company did?
Sure, yes. So these cases relate to the operation of motor vehicles on the road, and I believe it was...
And the administrative exception therefore applied? Because that's the piece I'm missing. How does it fit the administrative exception as opposed to, like, the automobile exception, which is actually a different exception?
Sure. So I'm using those cases to simply state that automobiles in parking and traffic are pervasively regulated. But then we can go on to the other steps of the test, which are set forth in New York versus Berger. And we look at what the statutory scheme is and the government's interests, and that the government's interest furthers the statutory scheme, and that it was the methods that were used were necessary to further that scheme. So moving forward with that, to assist in answering your question, the city's police powers and local ordinance authorize and define the scope of the search. There's no dispute in this case. Defendants are authorized to enforce parking. Plaintiff has admitted to same. Furthermore, as addressed by the district court, police powers do not allow just unfettered discretion. However, in this case, the officer's actions are limited to enforcement of parking only. There's an establishment of this Bureau of Enforcement. It's overseen by the city manager, who's able to regulate it. The ordinance, and there's local signage, and
signage doesn't say if you park here, you might be chalked.
That's correct. It doesn't specifically say chalking will be used to enforce parking here. That's correct. It does state that you are limited to 2 hours between, for example, the hours of 8 a.m. and 6 p.m., which are your general business hours. And I'd kind of, related to that, I'd like to mention that we're in a time period now where technology is significantly advanced. And at the time that chalking was used, even a few years ago, we didn't have the same applications and cell phones and technology that we do even today. Chalking was the only means by which the officer could use.
But when we talk about...
The only means? I thought the officer said she wrote down the license plates. I thought that was another means.
So my understanding is that she would write down the license plates and do the chalking. Now, in situations where she didn't chalk, those were when she would sit and just simply watch the one vehicle that she knows was a constant violator.
So is it your position that she did write down for each of these violations, or maybe many of these violations, so chalked and also noted the time? So in other words, he's going to have a hard time proving causation and damages? Is that your position?
Sure. Well, in terms of writing it down, that doesn't necessarily, it's not a reliable means by which someone can tell if the individual remained in that parking space for too long. For example...
Why not? If you write down the license plate and the time, and then you come back.
I thought she issued tickets on that basis. I thought you told me that earlier.
That's correct.
Okay, so then you say chalking is necessary to issue tickets. Well, I don't think it's necessary. She had another means.
It's the only viable means, though.
Why is that? When the other viable means is write down the license plate.
Sure. The chalk assists in parking enforcement because, for example, and the plaintiff testified to this herself, individuals would park in this parking lot. There was the local media group, MLive, that she worked at. These individuals, the employees who were working there all day long, would park and move their vehicle for 15 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever they needed, and return to their space. They are not in violation if they return back to their space because they have left and basically reestablished their new two-hour time period. Now, for example, if I'm Ms. Hoskins and I'm going around and this vehicle's in the same spot, that's actually maybe not accurate. But if you have a chalk mark and then the chalk mark disappears when she leaves and returns, that is an accurate way to tell that the individual either did or did not violate the two-hour time period.
I see.
Okay. All right.
So you want us to apply these exceptions, which Brother Counsel says still apply, administrative search exception, de minimis exception. I'm just wondering how we would know, because all of those, when they're doing sort of a reasonableness kind of balance, are really looking at the government's interests on one side and the expectation of privacy on the other side. So if the expectation of privacy is not our model, how do I balance out these exceptions? Like, how do I know that the administrative exception should apply in your case? I don't know what to put on. I know what to put on your side of the ledger. I don't know what to put on the other side, because I guess I'm not supposed to think about privacy. If I think about privacy, there's not much on that side of the ledger. You had a piece of chalk on your... You're parked in a public space on a public street, and now you have a piece of chalk. I don't... Not much on that side, but I don't know what I'm supposed to put in, given that we're not in a CATS regime. Can you help me?
Sure. So I would essentially mimic what Brother Counsel has stated, in that the Jones case establishes whether or not there is a search. And that basically flipped CATS on its head, or the way we looked at these cases, as you've just indicated. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of case law post-Jones that goes into and delves into all of these different tests, so that's very true. But when you look at it, I think you can separate Jones and Katz and basically state that those are for purposes of whether or not there's a search. And then we go into the second part of the analysis, and that's reasonableness. And under reasonableness, all of these different exceptions apply when you really delineate search versus reasonableness.
Right, but my point is that when they're balancing reasonableness, they're figuring out the government's interest, the government's need to conduct the search versus the intrusion on privacy on the other side, and is it reasonable? And if we're not supposed to think about privacy anymore, because then how do the exceptions still apply?
I would argue that you can still balance it that way under the reasonableness test.
So you still think we should be looking at privacy. So we should say, so in this case, why are you arguing administrative? Why are we not talking about de minimis? We just say, like, well, the damage to their privacy interest is really small. They're parked in a public street. They have a chalk line on their tire.
Certainly, and we presented that argument before the district court, and the district court had latched on to the administrative search. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of that was that this court had said before, we chalk this up to a regulatory exercise. But we did set forth the de minimis exception, and we have since cross-appealed to put that before the court here today.
Isn't it a little odd to talk about de minimis when the Supreme Court in Jones says, well, it's even though, as Justice Alito said in his dissent, all the privacy problems come not from attaching the beeper, but from monitoring the car for 26 days. That's your privacy problem. And the Supreme Court said, well, I mean, they didn't get to the reasonableness part, I guess. But they said, it's all we care about is the trespass to establish the search. So I guess I don't know whether I'm supposed to be thinking about it in those old ways or not. You would say yes. And so, yeah, okay. Fair enough.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can I ask you another question? Can I ask you about law of the case? So the district court said this was law of that the question of whether there was a search was law of the case. And therefore, it couldn't be argued anymore. You didn't appeal that. Like, your brief, I don't even think, talks about law of the case. I don't see it in there at all. Instead, you just argue de novo that, well, this is a search. But the reason the district court ruled against you was because it was law of the case, and you don't attack that reasoning. So have you just forfeited that argument?
No, I would submit to you that that's actually, you're correct, and that the Sixth Circuit, when we were here before under Taylor 1, as we yeah. jokingly call it, the court did state, you know, on the pleading stage, or at the pleading stage, there was a search, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And then the district court we had conducted some discovery. My understanding of the district court's opinion was that after the discovery stage, they did find a search, and so we appealed it on that basis, not the law of the land.
I see. Okay, we'll have to look back at that.
And with that, Your Honors, unless anybody has any additional questions for me, we otherwise rest on our briefs.
All right, thank you, Ms. Pike.
Thank you.
Allison, you've got 3 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. One thing I want to make sure we're very clear, and perhaps the district court was not clear enough on this, is we dispute that Ms. Hoskins used both methods. Her testimony was it's one or the other. It's not both. And that's what I think is important, because we're here on the tire chalking portion of this, not the writing down. Because we've asked the city to produce all records. They produce no records of anything being written down, despite the fact that Ms. Hoskins would be writing down literally hundreds of cars a day, and there's no evidence of that to support that whatsoever. You ask a question about the, and it gave me some pause here, because I've never considered asking whether the exceptions apply only in a CAT-style regime as opposed to a Jones-style regime. It's a different way to think about that I've never considered before until this morning. But one thing I would point out to this court is that once we establish that it's a search, And I said this earlier, but I want to make sure, because in response to your question about how do we structure this analysis, is it's the government's burden to show that the exception applies. It's not our burden. Once we're there, we hit the presumption standard and we go forward.
Okay.
And then lastly,
what should the law be? I mean, I think it's an open question as to whether the exceptions apply to a Jones trespass. And even though you may admit or concede that the law is that there are exceptions under Jones, your stipulation as to what the law is not binding on us. We decide what the law is, sure, irrespective of your argument. And I think maybe this case we will decide it. What should we rule? What is the better, more consistent rule, consistent with Jones and the Constitution, whether the CATS exceptions apply to Jones or don't?
As much as I would love to come to this court and say don't apply any exceptions in a Jones-style setup, I just don't think that that's going to be a plausible standard going forward.
Why?
Well, just largely because, for example, the Supreme Court just decided Coniglia, for example. And, of course, the question there in Coniglia was is that the individual, the officer went into the home of the individual to take their guns and, you know, that aspect of it. And of course, they threw out the community caretaking exception essentially going forward. What would be there if this was a Jones style, there was no exceptions whatsoever, there would be no accident circumstances exception whatsoever. And as a result, when the officer entered the home, you've committed a Fourth Amendment violation if there's no exceptions under Jones.
But some of those exceptions don't necessarily implicate or ask to implicate the privacy interest, do they? I mean, couldn't you view the administrative search exception as kind of a separate, there's just a three-part test or whatever it is, and we apply it or you don't apply it, and it's an exception? So I don't know. I mean, do you ultimately have to take into account the expectation of privacy or the degree?
I don't think so. And the reason being is that the standard that the court, that the Supreme Court has put forward was in, and Taylor adopted, it was both in Coolidge, which was the U.S. Supreme Court case that established that this once there's a search, it's per se unconstitutional unless the government's got another justification. The thing I'm struggling with today is that we use the word administrative search. Administrative search, it just means an alternative to a warrant requirement. It's not because this is a regulation, you know, because it's something the government can regulate, they're somehow exempted. It's not about the process, it's not about the fact that, about regulating parking. It's about tire chalking as a trespass, as a method of enforcing those particular rights. So I guess to answer your question, I mean, long way around the barn there would be is that, I still think you're going to have to deal with step one, step two. Step one, is it a search? If it's a search and there's no warrant, which is what we've established, it's per se with unconstitutional. Step two is now the government's got to come forward and convince to you. And again, the language that the Supreme Court uses is it has to be specifically established and well-delineated exception. And we don't have that here. We have no exception that meets that those standards. And as we've locked, and I'm not going to go through obviously now because I'm out of time, but we go through and point out where the shortcoming is in every exception that the government has the burden of proving and establishing. Thank you very much.
You're out of time. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you for your time today.
Ellison. The case will be submitted. You may call the next case.